husband thing's quite funny. For those listeners who don't know, my husband's Orthodox and got ordained as a rabbi himself. And I think one of the questions we are asked most commonly is, does he think of you as a rabbi? I don't want him to think of me as a rabbi. It's not because of the gender thing. He would not want to snuggle up at night with a rabbi. That's not his world. Don't want to be his rabbi. Hello and welcome to Rabbiting On. It's lovely to be back with you. I'm Rabbi Debbie Young Summers, and I am, as always, joined by my magnificent colleagues. We have up in our Manchester studio, Rabbi Robin Ashworth-Steen.
Hi.
Say hello. And in the Finchley branch, we have Rabbi Miriam Berger.
Hello.
It is lovely to see your faces this morning. We are going to kick off this morning by thinking about what is making us joyful. We are past Blue Monday into February. What is making you guys joyful at the moment?
Well, I have to say, because you just said about the seasons and going past Blue Monday, I did see snowdrops last week, so very early, but that really made me happy. But a lot of joy this week is I have a run of dual heritage wedding blessings. So that's a wedding blessing for a couple where one is Jewish and the other isn't. So I've got one this week and I've got lots of meetings about them. So just really that joy of a simcha and a gathering, which I think I am appreciating so much more than I ever did. So that's really lovely.
And the hope that's represented in the fact that people are now starting to really plan and think about how we can go forward rather than just rearranging weddings four times.
Yeah.
Wonderful. How about you, Miriam? What's bringing you joy?
Well, it's nice because we're heading into Rosh Chodesh Adar as well. So we get that like 60 days with our double leap year Adar of like enforced joy, which I think we definitely need to enforce this year because everybody needs a bit of joy. But this week we started a course run by Tselem, which Rabbi Robin set up. So a huge thank you. It's a course for clergy looking at social justice and how we can be the instigators of change and bringing about social justice. And so not only was it lovely to be able to really just take time out for reflection and learning and sort of the creation of this group, but also to really feel that what's lying ahead is an opportunity to kind of regroup and look at some of this work and really be able to say, how can we make our voices meaningful? So it was a great excuse to feel a bit of that opportunity for growth.
Wonderful. I had a lovely experience this week around something that might to non-rabbis sound like a negative experience, but we had a bereavement at the end of last week. And when the family contacted the synagogue, the son was very, very apologetic and really quite embarrassed. But his mum had said, you know, having grown up in a much more traditional community in Liverpool, and would it at all be possible to have a male rabbi? And I was the only rabbi around last weekend, unfortunately, but we could hire someone in if we needed to. And I called the family, honestly, just to wish them happy memories and see how they were doing and to say, you know, it's fine, I understand, and if there's anything we can do, because I'm not sure that bereavement is the time to put our foot down around things like this. And after chatting, he went back to his mum and had another conversation about it all and talked her round, basically. I went round to see them and we've become best friends. Going round for tea, and it just, you know, it all went kind of as you would want these things to go. We were able to really celebrate this life that had been lost. And people often think that doing all these funerals must be really hard, and it is a hard part of the job, but it's also such a privilege to kind of really take people through these hard times and allow them to feel what they need to feel so that they can get back to living and feeling joyful again. So it's a funny thing to feel joyful about, but it's kind of a family who have come now with us, I think. So that was really nice. So having talked a little bit about our joys this week, we're going to be focusing our episode on the joy of being a rabbi and all that that brings.
Can I just, I've got a question, Debbie. Can I?
Of course.
So we spoke a few weeks ago now about my previous career as a human rights lawyer and a bit about why I became a rabbi and why I think that's the solution to all of world's problems. I would love to know a little bit from you before we like really get into the joys of being a rabbi. Now we've chosen these paths. maths about what you two would have been if you hadn't have gone into the rabbinate. Not that I can imagine that, really. Both of you feel very rabbi. But maybe are we missing like an ambassador somewhere, a journalist, radio presenter, or even a drag queen stylist? Debbie, that's for you. So yeah, I'd love to just know where might you have ended up?
Well, I think I still could potentially be a drag queen. I don't feel that that's been ruled out yet. But my parents, when I was about 15 or 16, were very specific about what they saw for me in my life. They had decided that I was going to be a BBC religious affairs broadcaster, which is so specific. And actually kind of happened a few years ago when I ended up hosting a Sunday morning faith show on BBC Three Counties Radio. So that was really nice, and obviously doing kind of pause for thought and things like that. I feel like I've managed to fulfill their dreams for me. Until my late teens, I think I thought about being a drama therapist. I thought about being a teacher. I wanted to do interfaith work. And I realised at age 20, actually on a weekend away with Miriam, who I think was probably on commission for Leo Beck College at that point, that I did want to be a rabbi.
I just wanted nice people to be at the college at the same time as me. That's why I felt like I knew where I was going. I wanted nice people there too.
So I'd rejected the idea of the rabbinate with my own rabbi because I didn't really believe in God. Turns out that's not essential. But that weekend, I actually really came to terms with the God piece for myself. And again, I think that's probably another episode for another time. But once I sorted the God stuff out, it became really apparent to me that all of the jobs I had thought about doing were present in the rabbinate. And it also allowed me to kind of invest in community and to really help others find the meaning and joy and comfort that I found in my own Judaism. But having said that, I obviously didn't graduate university and go straight to rabbinical school. I thought I should try and get a little bit of worldly experience. So I spent a year working for what was then RSGB, Reform Synagogues of Great Britain, with Rabbi Tony Bayfield as my boss, as student field worker for the UK doing Reform Jewish students work and basically pretending to still be a student and sleep on everybody's floors. It was super fun. I then spent a year studying at a school called Paideia in Stockholm, which is a centre for Jewish studies in Sweden, of all places. And I then had a stint working for the Council for Christians and Jews, organising youth dialogue. And that dialogue part, I think, has stayed a really important part of my working life. So I would say I did huge amounts of voluntary dialogue stuff as well. So if anyone says, what was your career before this? I would probably say I worked in dialogue. But actually, the vast majority of my life has been heading towards the rabbinate.
I love that. It's all knitted together, all those different bits knitted into this one job. Wonderful. Miriam, how about you?
So I don't know if I've told the story about my careers guidance test before, but when we had to do these kind of automated careers guidance tests at school, when the teacher, the head of year, was handing them back out, I wasn't given mine. I was sent to the head of year. And I thought I'd failed it. I was like, how can you fail your career's guidance test? Like, it's ridiculous. Sort of very nervously went to my head of year because I was not a child that got into trouble. I was like, I've been told I need to see you to get my test back. And she was like, well, we're very worried. We know your dad's a rabbi and your career's guidance test has come back to say you should be a Christian minister. And I was like, I think that my dad might understand that actually, rabbi wasn't one of the boxes in the database, but this was quite close. It has always been a little bit part of who I am and where I saw myself going. Did actually, when we then had to do work experience, did with a Catholic priest because was living with a rabbi, all my life, and felt that would be a more interesting kind of way of seeing clergy, which was an amazing couple of weeks of my life, actually. Funnily enough, before that, when we were even younger and had done our first work experience, I asked Nicola Feuchtwang, who at the time was my Sunday school teacher at Aleph, but she's now a rabbinic student at Leo Beck, if I could do work experience with her as a paediatrician, because that seemed to be kind of what I wanted. It would have been a nice kind of path. I knew I was going to be a rabbi, but I sort of didn't want to make that statement yet. and realized that I loved what she did, making people better, and that sense of working with people and being there for them on that journey, but realized I wasn't really interested in the medicine or the science of it, just the people and the stories. And so, you know, took me in a bit of a different path as well, but sort of always knew that this was what I was going to do, unless I was going to be Annie on the West End stage, but without the ginger hair and without really the great singing voice or the ability to dance. This felt like the opportunity to get the stage every week without needing to audition.
There's definitely a drama element. Like I had a phase where I thought about being an actress, and this definitely has that kind of, you need your presence and your voice. And did you learn anything from your 2 weeks with the Catholic priest that you still return to today?
It was extraordinary. You know, and it was also before I'd met, obviously before I'd met my husband, I was still at school, and really did make me question that piece around getting married, having children. He was so there for his community, right? Like, yeah, you know, 100% available to them, not constantly trying to force the boundaries that are so difficult to preserve in terms of when, you know, what is it that gets dropped and what are you able to just let go of when your community needs you? He didn't have that struggle. And, you know, there were beautiful moments of it. He was in, it was a church in Notting Hill. So it was a really diverse community of really kind of extremes of socioeconomic, from the incredibly wealthy to the incredibly poor. And kids who, like teenagers who came to him on their way to school with horrific stories of kind of home life the night before. I did a few days with the nuns going to give communion to the housebound. And so doing that sort of, having a religious excuse to visit people in their homes was quite an interesting model of being able to kind of take religion to people when they're not able to come to the church, to the synagogue themselves. He had a school attached to the church, so there was that extra kind of dimension of community life. And they held, they had a kind of a drop-in for Eritrean women who had been forced to come to this country basically as workers and thought that they were coming here for a better life, and were then had their papers stolen from them and were basically sort of unregistered illegal immigrants here, treated incredibly badly. And I mean, that was eye-opening also in terms of the sort of the Messiah complex in each of us that leads us to this job of like wanting to help and fix people. That's really hard when you can't just say, you know, let me change the situation you're in. So definitely it was a fantastic combination.
I spent a few weeks staying at a Catholic seminary in India about 6 months after I realized I was going to be a rabbi. And it was part of a course on modern contemporary Indian religion that I was taking for my degree. And I became very friendly with one of the priests who was working there and coordinating our program. And I remember having a conversation with him over dinner one evening of, you know, he was the sort of person who you could just see would be a fantastic father. And I said to him, you know, do you not miss that you don't have that family, that parenting experience, and you'd be such a great dad? And he said, I'm father to my entire community. And of course, I'd never connected the fact that they actually are
they
called
even use
father.
The word. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he feels he has a parental role with all of the community. It was really, really interesting.
I often find people ask that question of, what about when you switch off, or when you're in the pub, or when you're out with friends, thinking that there's like this kind of other side to me, the non-rabbi side, where I suddenly, you know, it's as if you rip off your mask and you're somebody different. And I don't think that's ever been part of who I am. Is that normal? Do you have that other side? Do you feel you kind of have moments where you'd hate to be seen by a congregant because...
I bumped into a congregant in Aldi last Sunday, and I was fine about it. And she was like, I can't process that I would normally see you on the okay bimmer. And now you're an Aldi.
It would have been fine. I suppose it
was interesting. I'd come from a funeral, so I was in my kind of smarter gear. I wonder if I'd have felt differently about it if I'd been in, like, you know, sweatpants and no makeup.
Well, it's like seeing your teacher out of school, isn't it? It's the same kind of thing. But I think that's really healthy, really, Miriam. And we often, at rabbinic school, I remember we spoke a lot about, if you were out on a night out, as a rabbi, should you dance on the table if you're having a good time or whatever? You know, these kind of things about...
Robin, do you dance on the table?
I actually haven't, but I would. I mean, I love dancing.
At a Simcha at Jackson's Row,
even. Right, exactly. We love to dance here. But I think that's... And, you know, being joyful and having humour as part of a leader, I think, is vital. So I don't think that's something to hide. And that level of integration, Brené Brown said on her podcast recently that if you have a different set of values in your personal life to your professional, that's something to be worried about, right? The values and who you are, really, that idea of integration. But I mean, obviously, in a professional setting, when I'm leading a service, I am different to what I am when I'm sat at home watching Netflix and eating a takeaway, right? But that's just because we bring different parts of ourselves. But I wouldn't hide any parts of myself. And we're held up to ethics, aren't we, as rabbis as well? We've got an ethics code. And that ethics code is for every part of our life. So that integration for me is really important.
And even, presumably, you wouldn't be worried about what people were seeing you eating in that takeaway. Like, I think there's often people kind of that think there are these things that, like, oh, as long as nobody sees me. But actually, like, you know, I'm happy to kind of defend, to explain whatever I'm doing, because there isn't a sense that I'm keeping it hidden from my community.
It's tricky, isn't it, though? I remember I've been on a journey with this, because I found that I have turned, which I wasn't quite expecting to be a rabbi, is being a little mini celebrity. So that people do say, oh, I spotted you, rabbi, walking down the road, or will comment on things I've eaten or how I eat. I overheard a conversation of people talking, because I haven't held my knife and fork the wrong way around. They had a conversation about that. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting, actually. Although I'm very confident with who I am, the decisions that I make about my life and Jewish life, there is definitely an element of thinking someone will, you know, someone will see this or hear this. And I'm like, there is a process I go through of thinking about it. Does it change what I do? No. But I am aware that, like, the public private is very blurry in every single sense. Like, my congregants know where I live and will, you know, knock on and say hi on the door, which is gorgeous. There's beauty to that. But it does mean that element of what I do in one space and the other is, you know, something to think about and reflect upon.
I think that sense of bringing different parts of ourselves is really helpful. Like, if we're not authentic on the bimmer, even though there is a drama to it, but if we're not authentically being us, people can tell. They can, you know, see through inauthenticity. But I think there's also an interesting balance of kind of being rabbi on the school run and things like that,
yeah.
Where people see you. And I remember when my youngest was in reception, the very first birthday party we had, one of the mums introduced me to her husband. And the first thing he said was, oh, yes, you're the rabbi. I Googled you. It was like, why would you do that? And that I'd not thought about it as that kind of mini celebrity piece. That's a really interesting articulation of it, that there is this kind of almost weird fascination with these odd other people, the rabbis.
Yeah. I think it's really important to be aware of. I watched a documentary that Ruby Wax did on the BBC a few months ago about celebrities, and when they become so much part celebrity, they get completely misaligned with who they are. They lose who they are, and the fame and the power and being a celebrity takes over. And in that, I thought, gosh, that's a great warning to me as a rabbi, because there is an element of the power that comes with being a rabbi, the mini celebrity style. And that's not why I became a rabbi. It's not why I want to be a rabbi. I know it's part of the job because I'm a public leader, but I'd never want to, one, be like separated from my deep essence and why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I know that abuse of that power comes where I am seeking the fame and seeking those moments of, like, you know, adulation and, oh, you're wonderful, and the performance aspect of it, because that is part of the job, and it can take over because it's shiny and lovely because people say you're great. And that's, you know, but I'm that documentary was really helpful for me of, like, that's not what I'm chasing, that's not important to me, it's part of the job, but I'm going to do it with humility and laughter and focus on the things that really bring me joy in what I'm doing.
But I guess it's why I am so flummoxed sometimes when politicians get things so wrong. Because you can understand, you know, the footballer who just happened to be really good at football and then, like, you know, their life completely changed, or the pop star or the actor. There's something around sort of, you know, this came to me in a in an unusual way that I and my life was turned upside down. Whereas there's a piece, I try not to be kind of holier than thou, right? Like I'm, you know, on a Saturday morning, for instance, there are occasions where I'm not leading the service and I've not, and actually I need to not even be in a service because I just need that total break. But actually there are places that I wouldn't want to be seen at that time either, and would be really careful about, you know, where I was, so that nobody would say kind of, oh, you mean if you're not leading the service, you're just, you're, you know, you're at, I don't know, the supermarket or Kidzania or something. Because actually, no, like Shabbat morning is still Shabbat morning to me, whether I'm happening to be the rabbi that day or you know, or leading the service or not.
But there's something interesting in that, that we go into the rabbinate because we love doing Jewish and being there. But actually, if you're giving it to others every single Shabbat, it's you know, you sometimes just need to take time for your own Shabbat as well.
Right, and find other ways of doing it, because the traditional ways of doing it are feel sometimes that they're wrapped up in other things that are part of it not feeling restful and relaxing. But that, like, so during lockdown, there were a number of times where people would be like, are you happy to just sort of bend the rules a little bit? And I was really cautious of, actually, this is a time where I don't want to be seen to be nudging those rules. Like there's at this point I am representing something and I'm talking out in services about the importance of keeping these rules. Actually, I don't want to be that kind of two-faced sort of person, even if actually, you know, if we'd have been seven of us going for a walk rather than six, would it have been the biggest problem? And I guess that's why I've been so shocked by the constant revelations of politicians flouting the lockdown rules, because it's like, did you not realize that you'd be held to account on this? Did you not realize that there's not a distinction between private and public, that in whatever's going on in your flat, you're still the prime minister? Or, you know, when you're on, when you've taken your family because it's your wife's birthday, actually you're still in the public eye at those moments. I find that totally remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because there is all, for me, I am always rabbi. Like, I don't know about you two. I mean, in that I don't mean that I rabbi people. So, like, as a verb, I'm not like, you know, when I'm with my husband, I'm not his rabbi. You know, I'm not, certainly that's not the thing. Or to Gabriel, my son, or my closest friends. But being a rabbi is always present and part of who I am, because it's much more than just a job for me as anyway. And I also know, even if I think, oh, I'm not rabbi in this moment, people remind me that I'm a rabbi, and that it's always in the room for everybody. And I'm sure you've had like moments of being reminded that you're a rabbi, or thinking you're in a space where you're not, and then suddenly you are and you're providing a pastoral moment or whatever it is. Do you have any of those moments that resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of times I think people will suddenly say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm discussing this with a rabbi. You know, things around childbirth or drag, or, you know, something completely off field where people don't expect it. The husband thing's quite funny. For those listeners who don't know, my husband's Orthodox and got ordained as a rabbi himself nearly 3 years ago in Kashrut. And I think one of the questions we are asked most commonly is, does he think of you as a rabbi? I don't want him to think of me as a rabbi. It's not because of the gender thing. And of course, he does acknowledge that I am a rabbi and he's very proud of all that I do. And he does a huge amount to support me and enable me to do it. But he would not want to snuggle up at night with a rabbi. That's not his world.
We had a whole stream of B'nai Mitzvah years ago. It became like a thing at Bar Mitzvah parties. They'd often have kind of pick and mix at the party, like really aimed at the kids. I've got a very sweet tooth, and there was no chance that I was letting that pick and mix only be for the 13-year-old guests. And lots
wasn't
of people,
your wedding sweet themed?
There was a lot of sweets at our wedding too, yes. But the there's a photographer in the community, Graham Schweden, who's often used by families in the community for their simchas. And he had like a series of photos at one point where each of these bar mitzvah parties, there was like the rabbi surrounded by all these kids with her trying to grab the sweets kind of thing. It was one of those things.
Sounds like an exhibition waiting to happen.
Not very rabbinic that you're needing the sweets, but it's just who I am and I'm not someone different. Although we did have the summer before, like summer 19, we'd gone on a really gorgeous holiday where we had flown to Costa Rica, spent one night in a hotel near the airport after a very long flight, then been on a coach for like 3 hours to get to a boat, and then been on a boat for an hour to get to our first like proper hotel. And it was hot and it was sweaty and we'd been traveling for what felt like days. And we went straight to our room, got into swimming stuff and walked straight to the pool. And as I took those first steps into the water, I heard the words, Rabbi Miriam. I was just like, what? How far do you have to come? And this gorgeous guy, absolutely lovely, who his immediate thing was, can we take a selfie? I want to show Sharon Goldstein, Sharon and Andrew Goldstein, that I've bumped into you, that like I'm so far from my rabbi, but I'd love to show them you're here. And I was just like, I'm really happy to have this photo taken, but not right now. this is not a rabbinic selfie moment. In fact, this is just not a selfie moment at all for me in my swimming stuff. But it was that kind of thing of like, it doesn't matter how far you go, you can't think you've ever escaped the title.
And even if it's people you don't know, particularly on holiday or, you know, when someone says just conversation, oh, what do you do? And there's that kind of moment of, how honest am I going to be right now? And what's this conversation going to lead to? Am I going to end up spiritually counseling someone on the ski lift?
We went to the Galapagos, Johnny and I, as part of our honeymoon. And you can only be in the Galapagos on a boat. And somehow the boat that we were on seemed to be a lot of American grandparents who, it's a thing that they take their bar mitzvah age grandchild on like a special holiday for their bar mitzvah. Like that seemed to be who we were with on this boat. And we were like, okay. So, and you sit with people at mealtimes. So there was often the conversation of like, what do you do? And Johnny would always start because it's boring, right? Like he would start, he'd be, oh, well, I work in an accountancy firm. I'm a tax consultant, da, da, da. You'd see them glaze over. You'd see them turn to me and be like, and you, hoping for a different answer. And I'd be like, I'm his secretary. Not just, okay.
Yeah. That's
but that sounds like a very interesting story, the married couple.
Oh, I've got a question for you both. So all of the things we've been speaking about, I think my eyes were relatively open to coming into the rabbinate. I also did work experience when I was 14 in Manchester with Rabbi Silverman, and did work experience later when I was at rabbinic school with Miriam. I spent a week with you and decided I was glad I hadn't done it before rabbi school, because I was like, I don't think I can do it. It's too hard. I remember I had to text you one night and say, I can't do another 12-hour day. It's too much. Anyway, but I was there. I think I was in fifth year by then. So I was like, it's too late. So like some of the stuff we'd spoke about at college, I was very aware that it was, you know, this public-private thing, boundaries, the work-life balance, which is perpetual. Like I'm still struggling with that. Like, how do you do it? How do you even hold on to your day off, let alone having an evening off during the week, all of that stuff. But one of the things I think I wasn't so aware of, and I'd be really interested to see with your reflections on this and other bits that you've learned over the years, is the conflicts that happen in community. So I remember early on there was a conflict that arose. It was just so much time and energy went into holding someone really in pain who was acting out in community. I'm sure we've all been there. Daily basis. And I said to Rabbi Laura Jana Klausner at the time, this is too hard. Like I have so much to do and I don't have time. And she's like, but Robin, that's the work. The work is being with people in pain, helping them get through it and helping them still find a space in community through the hard conversations and the distress. And I was like really resentful about it, because I'm like, but community is kumbaya and it's like gorgeous and stuff. And I've now realized, of course, that is where the work can be, is the I guess it's the dialogue piece you're talking about, Debbie, of like really accompanying people and being witnesses and agitators alongside, like being able to challenge and comfort alongside through the pain, whether that's in community, in their personal lives, at work or whatever. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on either if that's like your experience, but also is there stuff that you've was new to you when you came into Rabbi, like, oh, I wasn't expecting that?
I think for me, the biggest surprise, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more about this in our next episode, where we're thinking more about celebrating women in the rabbinate, but I grew up in a community where from the age of five, I only saw women rabbis. And I think we're the first generation that can really say that. And there was never a question for me of, can I do this as a woman? It was, do I want to do this? It was just another option on the platter of jobs. And when I got to Leo Beck College at 24, it was a revelation to discover that actually things are not on an even, or then certainly were not on an even playing field everywhere. I think massive amounts has changed since then. But, you know, in a class of six women and two men, the men definitely got things that others didn't and got the jobs first and were, yeah, there was definitely a difference. And that was a surprise, I think. But it's also been part of the joy of, again, taking people on those journeys of, I can do this job and my gender actually is irrelevant. And we're meeting everyone as who they are. But that piece around holding the difficult conversations, I suppose, and the difficult people, it's, I think it's something that we're learning all the time because every situation is so different. And they're not always skills that we can learn beforehand. You just have to kind of be present in each space and find what you can find. I think I'm not sure I expected to have to think on my feet all the time in every time. Conversation, endlessly surprised by what people bring, but also endlessly not surprised because everyone we meet is kind of just living life and wanting to connect somehow, which is what I love about it.
That's great.
I suppose I had quite a different insight into the rabbinate because mine came with living not with a congregational rabbi, but my dad was head of the movement. And so the conflict piece, I don't think came as a shock because essentially what he was dealing with was the conflicts of 40 synagogues all at the same time. So that piece was quite present in our kind of family understanding of what his job was about. I guess I had quite a different understanding of what the congregational rabbinate might be because I'd been so little when he stopped being a congregational rabbi, but still had all the joys of what it had felt like to be growing up in that and sort of still be associated as sort of the rabbi's family in that kind of privileged and very lovely way. I think it's interesting that like we're going to take Debbie's conversation further, I think, about that whole being a woman in the rabbinate piece, you know, with Rabbi Jackie Tabak and kind of take that conversation further. I think for me, one of the biggest insights is how much technology has changed our rabbinate and the expectations around our availability and kind of who and where we are. So we had two landlines at home and one of them permanently had an answer phone on it. And that was the phone number that we were allowed to give anybody that wasn't like our absolute nearest and dearest. And we were never allowed to answer that phone. That was like, you know, essentially the work phone, and it would go to answer phone. You'd see who it was before you'd pick it up. And that was like, you know, Dad would phone them back in office hours. And, you know, the idea that we have phones on us all the time with our emails and WhatsApp and text messages coming through all the time, that somebody will, you know, will send an email on a Saturday afternoon and not have got a reply by Saturday night. So we'll send a WhatsApp on Saturday night saying, I don't know if you see my email, but this is why I need you to call. It's like, this is not life and death. And it's Shabbat or it's the weekend. Yeah. Like actually at that point you want to go, you know, I'm also a 40-year-old woman allowed to be out on a Saturday night. But, you know, there isn't any of that sense of boundaries. I do kind of miss the fact that he got letters that, you know, it would take a couple of days for the letter to arrive. Then he'd be expected to open it and read it and reply. And then it would take a couple of days to go back. And meanwhile, those conflict moments can be playing out with emails copied into all sorts of people and sent far and wide and all of that kind of thing, which as the rabbi, you're also trying to rein in and conflict also being about how people communicate with each other on platforms that people notoriously communicate badly on.
And actually with social media, which I know actually Miriam is very good at being bantered about and is kind of not really present in the way that Robin
and I
are.
Because I'm kind of scared of it.
Yeah, but I think you're probably right to be, because it's one of those things where at 10 p.m. on a Saturday night, I can get a messenger message or a tweet message, direct message on Twitter or whatever. And it, you know, it is being able to put those boundaries in somehow.
And actually the message doesn't scare me as much as the, you know, what do you think, Rabbi Miriam, about this, you know, event, this anti-Semitism, this what this person said, that, and actually can you just comment for the entire world to see at 11 o'clock at night in only a few lines, because nobody can be bothered to read nuance at that moment, like oh goodness no, like I don't want to.
Yeah
But that is the pressure. I've started doing a job diary, partly to just really see like what the job of a rabbi or what my job is and where's my energy going, partly so I can work with my community on where we need support. Anyway, and I realized you could see the notifications, how many emails you got on your phone. So I've started to do that. And the first day I did it, I had 70 notifications on my work phone. I have separate phones. I had 150 on my personal phone and 80 emails come in. And that was outside of meetings, which were like all day, and phone calls and things like that. And I thought, no wonder it's stressful. Like if that's the pressure, it's like constantly. So, and I'm sure this is not just about being a rabbi at all, but it's like someone constantly just tapping you on the shoulder. Excuse me, what do you think about? And some of the messages that we get are, you know, I'm really struggling with whether I should get my son circumcised on a WhatsApp, you know, what do you think? And it's like, I don't know. That it's really that precious. It's really helpful to name it, I think. And then it's helped me to think, okay, how am I going to start to hold some of this in a way that is doable and manageable? But I would have loved that landline phone.
all this technology stuff is really new. And I think it's also kind of astonishing that we are still, in a way, really new. It's within living memory that we have been ordaining women institutionally within progressive Judaism. And so actually it's an amazing pleasure and privilege that on our next edition we're going to be able to welcome our very own Rabbi Jackie Tabak, who was the UK's first female rabbi, who was ordained in 1975. And actually this year it's 50 years since 1972 when Rabbi Sally Priesand was ordained by Hebrew Union College. That was the first woman rabbi in America. And of course, hopefully next time we'll get to say a little bit more about Rabbi Regina Jonas, who was the first woman rabbi that we know of, ordained in Germany in 1935. There are other women who it would be worth maybe mentioning through Jewish history who've brought in their own ways of taking on parts of the rabbinic role. But we are really looking forward next time to being joined by Rabbi Jackie Tabak, who is now the convener of our Bet Din and, you know, still a working rabbi. History is still with us and unfolding before us. But it has been so fabulous to reflect on some of the joys, but also some of the challenges of being a rabbi today with you two. You might not know that you can find us on Rabbiting on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and on all the usual places, as well as on YouTube, where you can watch us, which might be a horror show. But then you can also meet me early in the morning, not you two. You two are a delight to behold. But you can watch along with subtitles there if that is preferable. But however you want to join us, thank you for being with us. We will see you all next time. And thank you to Robin and Miriam.
Thanks, Debbie. Bye.
Nice to see you.